Welcome, welcome, welcome. My name is Scroobius Pip, and this is episode 133 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. And my guest today is James McAvoy. What an amazing guy. This is an interesting one because it's the first time I've been let in the front door of a press junket. So it's a short one, but I think we got a lot in, and he was a really interesting dude. Because it's short, I'm going to have a bit of a ramble, but I'm going to do that at the end because people get a bit annoyed when there's a long intro. So if you want to hear me tell you about stuff like Taboo, which launched on the BBC this week, which stars me, and other interesting stuff, then I'll chat about that at the end. But I will just start this opening bit by saying we are brought to you by speechdevelopmentrecords.com, which is my website and my record label. You can go there to get CDs, DVDs, t-shirts, mugs, all that good stuff. And if you are new to the Distraction Pieces podcast, have a little thumb through our back catalogue. We've had guests such as Simon Pegg and Paddy Considine and Frankie Boyle and Sarah Pascoe and Josie Long and some really good people. So check it out. I'm trying to think of other ones I can really lure you in with. We've had Russell Brand on. Who else is good? Edith Bowman's wonderful. We've had loads of good people. So hopefully you'll have a little thumb through our back catalogue and check some of them out. Nick Frost. Yeah, just good people. Anyway, I'm going to get on with the podcast. This is episode 133 with James McAvoy. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. I'm joined today by James McAvoy. How are you, sir?
I'm good, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for giving me some of your time. I know it's a bit of a... I've seen from your Instagram, it's a bit of a whirlwind at the moment of promotion and excitement. How's it all been going?
It's been going good. We've been all over the place. We've been Philly, New York, Paris, Madrid, Milan. We're here. We're going to Berlin. Then we're going to finish off in New York again. So it's good. We're spreading the word.
How is it doing these kind of press runs? Because the nature of acting and certainly someone in demand as much as you is, you'll probably be a project or two on from that now.
Yeah,
so does it give you a chance to get to revisit it and get excited again about about something you'd kind of had a bit of a breather or recovery from?
Yeah, it's been a year since I finished this film, but yeah. I've done two more films since then. So, yeah, no, I've had a big breather. It's nice to return. It's nice to see people that you got really close to and then, you know, didn't see again for a year.
And might not see again for years. Such an intense industry in that way, isn't it? That you're thrown so deeply into that and then pulled apart.
I think it's very difficult when you're beginning in the industry and you make these incredible, deep, sort of very open and very vulnerable relationships with each other, and then it just stops, and then you never see that person again for years, maybe ever.
Yeah,
but you get used to that quite quickly, and you don't stop yourself from making those relationships. You just know that it's going to end.
I was going to say the key there kind of has to be a learning that it is exactly that. There's nothing false about them relationships. It's just an intense, heated up individual situation that's then, again, as said, you're all pulled apart and scattered around.
So. Yeah, and also the alternative is that you don't engage with people.
Yeah.
The alternative is that you go, all right, well, this won't last forever.
Yeah.
Well, I won't engage with anybody then. And so you don't live your life. You don't make any connections. And that's it'd be rubbish. It's absolutely rubbish.
How exciting was it? I saw a split earlier this week and loved it. How exciting was it as an actor to get a role like this where you essentially get to play 20 or so characters without having to remake Big Mama's House or anything like that? You kind of get to jump into a lot of different characters and areas.
I'm expecting the call for Big Mama's House.
You didn't even have to have loads of makeup or
no, we go the other way. There's no makeup. There's none of that. No, it's just the essence of the character. It's the essence of the person. Yeah. And it's also the truth of people that live with DID.
Yeah.
They don't always change their appearance when although some people do, some groups of people that live plurally do. But I think that certainly dramatically, it was more interesting to show the changes in somebody without just handing the audience an easy code that said, oh, who is he now? What's happening now? Yeah. Put a wig on. Oh, you've been a woman now. Okay, yeah. Fine. I can check out. I can just relax. I can sit back and disengage. Whereas if you are, you know, you're not giving obvious signals like that. You're doing much more subtle work and subtle code work than that. So, you know, it's about posture and it's about hand gesticulation. It's about the shape of your mouth. It's about the shape of your face, which you are capable of changing, you know. Yeah. So stuff like that.
Yeah, and it's an interesting one, how instantly recognisable each character became because of their mannerisms and their gait, rather than just of their accent. At first, yeah. You're kind of listening out for voices, and after that, you're kind of like, oh, right, I know who's in the room now.
Yeah, no, exactly. It was important that they were all clearly defined in a high definition.
Yeah,
that. Even at the beginning, the audience would know that somebody had changed and someone else was now in charge.
Yeah.
And that by halfway through the film, at least I wanted people to be able to know exactly who they changed into before you'd really said anything.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's the fun of the film for an audience, I think, as well, trying to pinpoint who it is they're playing with and who it is that's telling the story to them. And it's just the vastly interesting thing about somebody that lives with DID.
Yeah, yeah. So how much a freedom did you have to really delve into each individual character? Because I'd imagine it has to be finding a bit of a balance there, because in a role, I'm sure you'll throw yourself hugely in and get the backstories and get everything in there. But when you're having to play so many, was it a finding a balance, or did you get to really know each individual, each personality?
I felt like I got to know each individual personality really well. There's a difference in approaching some of them, dramatically anyway, in that, you know, Kevin is born because his mum and dad had sex.
Hmm.
And he is the way he is because of all the things that have happened to him in his life up to that moment.
Yeah, sure.
And when you usually build a character, you try and pinpoint the key defining aspects of what has happened to them. And that's the same as you and me, but like with the other eight characters that I portray in this film, they are all alter egos that grew out of him at a time later in his life, and they weren't necessarily born in the same fashion. And The reason that they were born to in a way perform a certain function. They were born because of a certain need that Kevin or the community later on that live within that same body all needed something that they weren't capable of doing, it seemed.
Yeah.
And so that attribute of that group or that one person that was able to kind of take care of that would almost personify.
Yeah.
And so, of course, they grow and they develop and they become much more than that key attribute. But that key attribute seems to be the thing that propels them forward. And therefore, you are delving back into their histories.
Yeah.
But more than that, you're trying to define their key attribute and then build a history around that.
Yeah, the moment that created them as such, the reason they were needed.
The moment that created them, but also sometimes it's not even the moment that created them. Sometimes it's the collected history of someone else that created them.
Yeah.
It's the key defining prime mover that propels them. And some of the characters, some of the personalities that live within that body are very broadband, if you like. They've got multiple interests. They have, you know, they pay their taxes, they've got a job, they've got hobbies, they've got girlfriends, boyfriends, they've got, you know, neighbours they don't like, neighbours they do like. Some of the other personalities, like Patricia, who I play, who's, one, been ostracised and kind of ghettoised within the community, and she's been suppressed.
Yeah.
She's not been allowed out, if you like, for the better part of 5 years.
Mm.
You know, her spectrum is more narrow, and she's very faith-based, and she defines herself entirely about that. That faith has been warped because she's been suppressed so long.
Yeah.
But some of the other characters, like Barry, like I say, they're very broad spectrum and actually living a fully productive life.
Yeah, yeah. It's as a film in general, and hearing you talk now, it puts forward some really interesting a subject matter, really, on the power of the mind as such, and its ability to not only have different approaches and attitudes, but also to affect the body, to change the body. Was that an area you got to look into much or research much? I've got a guy on the podcast in a couple of weeks called Wim Hof.
Who's a Dutch guy, I know who you're talking about.
The Iceman, and he's found
techniques through breathing techniques to increase the oxygen levels in cells, to fight illness, to control body temperature. And it's a fascinatingly not yet understood area, right? That we have that bit more control, even looking at sugar pills and placebos that under test conditions, that two sugar pills have more effect than one sugar pill, even though there's nothing in them, but test conditions.
Yeah, but because you believe you're taking something that will cure you, your body decides to try and cure itself.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work on everybody, but it seems to work on some people.
There seems to be something there,
And it doesn't seem to work on, it's not just that it seems to work on some people, but not others. It'll work on some people sometimes and other people other times as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what is that? You know, we know and it's sort of pop knowledge, really, that we only use 30% of our brains or something.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, that might be slightly inaccurate, but we use only a small percentage of our brain, and we really don't understand what it's capable of. But people with DID particularly have had instances of one personality that lives within the same body being allergic to bee stings and having anaphylactic response to a bee sting, and then another personality who, when stung by a bee, is absolutely fine. There's a part in the film where we talk about a woman in Germany who had DID, but that it wasn't apparent to people. She didn't switch alters commonly, but that one of her alters was blind, and that when she switched to that alter, she did become clinically blind. Her eyes would not move, her irises would not even dilate. She couldn't see anything, but there was no physical response that could be stimulated by the medical community when she was in that state, when that personality had control.
Yeah.
It's just fascinating.
Yeah, it really is, because you kind of hear mythical fables of someone lifting up a car in an extreme situation to save someone. But then the fact is, I'm sure you'll have experienced this. If you've had a busy schedule, the moment you get some time off is normally when you'll get ill, because your body kind of knows that, oh, I can relax now, or I've got time to get ill. So it's stuff that everyone experiences, that there is a level of mind control over over our bodies and our cells as such.
Yeah, completely. I think it's just something that, you know, if even just on a very simple level, if you're angry, your heart rate increases.
Yeah.
That is your mind controlling your body. That is, it might not be a conscious form of control, but it is an emotional and mental response to your environment, which is affecting your physical state and capabilities.
Yeah.
It's not an extraordinary one. It's not a supernatural one. It's not a super one. If it's true on that tiny level, all you're doing is amplifying it and make it bigger.
Yeah, completely. Is the mind something that naturally intrigues you? Because your film choices, there seems to be a lot where you're drawn to that kind of interest in areas, from the extremes of Professor X to trance to this. There seems to be a fair few points where you're getting to look into the intricacies of this kind of unexplored and unknown.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I think as an actor, I spend my everyday at work trying to figure out why people behave the way they behave and trying to figure out why we are, as the human race, the way we are. And so in a way, we're shit psychologists. You know what I mean? We're pseudo-psychologists. Yeah. And I love it. It's a great way to spend your days. You know, most people are too busy doing their due to have time to sit and think about why we got here, why am I here like this?
Yeah.
Where am I going? And I get to do it every day. And with all that work you're talking about, and the stage work I've done is the same as well over the last few years. I don't know. I think that trying to figure out why somebody behaves the way they behave is a really interesting thing to do when they're just behaving normally. It's an exceptionally interesting thing to do when they're behaving as what the rest of society labels as abnormally.
Yeah.
And so the parts that I've played quite often over the last 5 or 6 years have been in that realm because of the most interesting things I've been sent.
Yeah, yeah. And does that, I'd imagine that kind of, in exploring the motives and motivations behind other characters and other people, it must open things up for yourself as well as a person. That you must learn a lot from these, at times fictional characters, at times based on real characters, but from these strangers in exploring them in a way we don't do to ourselves. It's rare we'll sit down and go, so 2 weeks ago, why was I in a shit mood on Thursday? Thing. Do you know what I mean? Whereas if it's a work thing and you're studying someone else, maybe it allows you to go into further depth.
Yeah, no, it does, definitely. And I'm also not really a method actor, or I don't become the character.
Yeah.
It's my point of view that all I've got is me.
Yeah.
I am everything you see when I play a part. All I've got is me. I'll give you all of it, but it's all I've got. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so by exploring a character, you are exploring yourself.
Yeah.
By exploring a character's experiences that you don't have any understanding of, you're relying on your empathy, imagination, and your intellect to get some knowledge, do some research, but then your empathy and imagination to actually put that into you.
Yeah.
And so it's more the character is becoming you, I think. Don't get me wrong, I don't think they should play every character the same way every time. I'm not like that actor.
No, but I completely understand your point there of adding to yourself
and a little bit,
drawing out the similarities that you have.
Yeah,
because I think, so suppressing the bits that might not be,
yeah,
but drawing
out
the similarities.
Yeah, I think the key characteristic that human beings have that manages to elevate us and make us way better than animals is, if we are indeed better than animals.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing that I think actually... I'll go out on a limb here for anybody that's pro-animal. We're better than animals, all right? The thing that makes us 10 times better, or at least that's got us where we are, I think, is the ability to imagine. And and empathy is that key to imagination, you know? Having feelings for another creature, and to have feelings for another thing is to project emotion, and that takes imagination. To project love is an imagined thing. I imagine what it's like to be you, and I like you, and so we invent love, and so why am I saying all this? why am I saying that? It was important. It was good. Oh, I don't know.
But as I said,
Imagination is key, really. I think it's the most important thing. Yeah, I totally went off track. I'm done. No, I'm totally done.
That's all good. It's going to sound like an odd and trite thing, but something I've always noticed along your career is a great ability to master and use accents and different voices. Is that something that you focus on a lot for getting into a character more? Is it something potentially that's born of coming up as an actor in Scotland, where there wasn't the strongest film industry, so maybe you had to assimilate a British accent to get more roles and things like that. Was that?
Yeah, no, growing up in Glasgow, graduating from drama school in Glasgow. Actually, going into drama school in Glasgow, I could do like a couple of things.
Yeah.
I'd only done a couple of bits of acting.
Yeah.
I could be angry, and I could be from where I was from.
Yeah.
And I could be emotional, and that was kind of it, I think.
It's great, because you'll see certain actors like a De Niro or a Pacino and think, well, that's Pacino. So an increased version of him, that's all I need to do as an actor. If you know what I mean, an increased version of me, I'll know where I'm from, I can be angry, I can be sad. And then, obviously, I assume from going to acting school, you then learn, right, there's more to it than that.
From the start, just being me and being where I was from wouldn't get me much work, unfortunately, because there's no stories being told about people where I come from.
I had Riz Ahmed on, who's done great in America recently. He was saying how he was stunned to have to go to America to find the roles for an Asian man, because in the UK there's so much period stuff where there are no brown people. And he had to go to America to suddenly go, right, you're more than just an Asian guy. You're just a human here. So
I completely agree. But we don't make product for ourselves. We make product to try and succeed in America.
Yeah.
And British product. And this isn't America's problem. This is our problem. The product that we make, that we sell to America, they want a certain thing. They want old world.
Yeah.
They want the old country. Do you know what I mean? They're a young country. They're only a couple of hundred years old, really. And they want to know about their grandparents.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. They've not history that we've got. So that's
They don't really want to know about all their grandparents. They want to know about ye olde nice sort of royal grandparents. And that's fine. That's what they want. They're entitled to that.
Yeah.
But it's our problem, because that means that so much of our product is filled up with that stuff. And that's why he then has to go to... We're not making product for ourselves. They're making product for themselves.
Yeah.
They're making product that's way more diverse than ours.
Yeah,
don't get me wrong, it's not good enough yet. It's still not completely representative. But They're making stuff themselves, but we don't make stuff for ourselves. It's weird. I was just in France and they were asking about the film industry and why it's so samey. Why is everything the same and the problems with the Western film industry? And I was like, by that, do you just mean like English-speaking films? And they were like, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, because French film, they make films for themselves. They don't care if anybody sees them in America. Anyway, it's a tangent. Yeah, growing up in Scotland and in my particular part of Scotland or my kind of, you know, there's that sort of bracket that I grew up in. There's nobody telling stories about people that sounded like me, looked like me. So I couldn't do an Al Pacino or a De Niro and sort of just always be myself. Not that they're always themselves, but they are sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I had to be able to do accents, and I was lucky that with drama school, it gave me the opportunity to really experiment, and it seemed like I had a facility to do that.
Yeah.
And when I came out of drama school, I was able to do a hell of a lot more than I was able to do when I went in there. Because the great thing about drama school, and this is for anybody that wants to be an actor, you're not going to come out and get a career like handed to you in a plate, and you've got to be good and all that, and you've got to work hard, but either way, you're going to get to do 20, 30, 40 plays in 3 years.
Yeah.
And
it's amazing.
You'll never get to do that in the industry.
Yeah.
Even if you have an amazing first 3 years of your career, you're never going to get to do that much work. And you get to do all that work without the threat of losing your job or not getting another job. You're there for 3 years. You are being judged, but you're never going to get kicked out. For not being good enough. So you get to experiment and you get to grow in a safe environment. And I got to do that. So I came out, said to my agent, what kind of stuff do you think I'm going to get? Every other agent had said to me, like, you know, you'll go up for this. I'm putting you up for this right now. I'll put you up for it today if you like, and you can go in for it. You don't need to sign on with me. But you can go. So I said to my agent, I was like, what are you going to do? You're going to put me up for it? And she was like, not until you sign on. And I was like, all right. I was like, what kind of stuff do you think I'll go up for? And even she was like, probably just Scottish stuff, like young runaway rent boys and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And I was like, brilliant, sounds good, sign me up. And then the first job I got was playing a posh Englishman and had been for like years after that, to the point where like people would phone her up and go like, can James do a Scottish accent? And which is kind of cool.
It must have been amazing. So how was it to build a name doing a lot of posh British accents, doing American accents, to go around the world and really climb and get acclaim and plaudits, and then get to come back and do filth and be Scottish and be that roughness that you were talking about initially being put up for, kind of a film that is based around essentially rent boys and that kind of area. It's Edinburgh rather than Glasgow, is it not?
That film's Edinburgh, it's not Glasgow. Yeah.
But still, to get to return to that and play a Scottish character, how enjoyable was that?
It was brilliant. It was brilliant. It came sort of... Did it come back to back? It might have come back to back with doing Macbeth with an all-Scottish cast on Whitehall.
Wow.
Right next to 10 Downing Street. So, I don't think it was quite back to back, but there wasn't much time in between them.
Yeah.
So that was amazing. It was brilliant. It was... it wasn't necessarily the fact that it was Scottish that got me all excited. It was just a personal connection to that character.
Yeah.
And it was a really... What I think... I've done a lot of things recently about people who are having mental problems.
Yeah.
But all of them, maybe with the exception of Macbeth, have been done in... Macbeth as well. It just wasn't funny, Macbeth. Although we did get a couple of laughs in my Macbeth. All right. All right. What am I saying here? All of these films haven't been like a gritty, realistic social commentary approach.
Yeah.
They've all been artistic pieces of entertainment with a vibrant dynamic and an emphasis on entertaining way of examining and presenting these scenarios, which I think is really important because, and don't get me wrong, like my favorite director is possibly, you could argue, is like the daddy of that kind of cinema is Ken Loach.
Yeah.
And I love that kind of cinema, but I don't like it when that kind of cinema is just going, oh, isn't that a shame, isn't that a shame, isn't that a shame, everything's terrible. I think there's a way to explore things vibrantly, to make people feel and understand and have sympathy and transport them and engage their empathy and imagination in a way that isn't just... you should feel bad that this is happening.
Completely.
And you should feel like a good person because you're watching this film.
Because you're watching this and
yeah, you're not going to do anything about it, but you feel like a good person.
Completely.
Whereas the kind of films I think...
You're going to do a post on Facebook about it, saying how important it is.
Yeah, totally. Whereas the films that I've done, I feel like they're not going to change the world either, do you know what I mean? But that at least, I don't know, they're just not... They're not pretending that you're a better person because you've watched this film.
Yeah.
It's actually made people squeamish and made people feel bad and feel and laugh, but they've made people feel bad and laugh at the same time for watching this film. Do you know what I mean? Which I quite like.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think there's that in Filth and in Split and numerous others where there is that on a surface level. I mean, Split in particular, it's a creepy, uncomfortable thriller of a movie, but it is also, it educated me on certain parts of that disorder, and it cleverly addresses all that while still going, no, you can just switch off and be entertained here. This can be entertainment.
Yeah.
Or there's more woven into this.
I also think, because I've been asked a couple of times, how do you feel about somebody actually said banalizing? And I was like, what's banalizing? Like making it banal? And she was like, yeah, banalizing. And I was like, banalizing? Banalizing? All right. Well, at the risk of making it banal, I was like, well, what's the other option? The only other option is to say that because you've got a mental condition, and in this particular case, because you've got DID, you're not allowed to be a super badass supervillain. And I was like, well, that's a bit discriminatory.
Yeah.
And you're not allowed to be in a film that's entertaining.
Yeah.
I was like, what? You're only allowed to be in a really sad, dull film that's like it's filmed in black and white, and like two people go to see it, and it might win an award, but it's actually just fucking mental health porn.
Completely.
Like, nah, you're all right.
And that's what I loved. It managed to do that, but at the same time, whilst paying respect to the condition and to the situation, it'd be easy in a film like this to almost make a mockery of the different characters and all. Do you know what I mean? It could go too far in that direction, but I thought, yeah.
No. That's a lot down to our director, M. Night Shyamalan, and he has a fascination with this condition, and he has done for a long time. But he also has a huge amount of he's kind of in awe of this condition, and he's also got a lot of respect for it as well. And then hopefully, his idea in hiring me was that he seems to think that I'm an actor that can elicit sympathy and compassion from the audience.
Yeah, sure.
And so that by doing that, and me actively trying to do that, help an audience, even when some of the characters are doing bad things, at times give the audience an opportunity to understand and feel for those characters, and at times like those characters as well.
Yeah. So I'll start to wrap things up as we're getting close to our end point. Is it key to you to have the variation of stage, of more action-driven films as, or through now, Riz Ahmed, actually, I know Aaron Creevy, who did A Welcome to the Punch. I thoroughly enjoyed that.
Thank you.
An action film in London, in one of the best landscapes, best locations that we never use for gritty or for American-style big action.
Yeah.
So to do things like that, and obviously there's X-Men and all these, but then to do ones like Filth or Split even, that feel like they're kind of going a little bit more cerebral. Is that a key balance for you to keep it interesting?
It's the thing that keeps it interesting is when it's, one, a challenging script. If it was exactly like something else I'd done before, then I'd probably ditch it. But really it's just, is it a good script? Is it a good character? Is it a story that I feel is going to be an interesting one for the audience to listen to and watch? If it's got something about it that's going to teach me something new, give me a fresh challenge, then yeah. But in terms of what genres and stuff, I never really go by genre. I couldn't tell you what genre I want to do next.
Yeah.
Only thing I would like to do is like a straight up comedy, because I've not done one in a long time.
Yeah. And Shameless was kind of the first of its kind to be an adult comedy drama.
Yeah.
But you kind of got to play the straight role in that. So you didn't get to do the comedy side of it.
I got nominated for Best Comedy Newcomer that year.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? And I'd done.
I was being serious. God damn
it. No. I'm telling you, I was like, I don't understand. I'd been in a film or two where I'd been playing like a straight up comedy guy.
Yeah.
But in that was what I was nominated for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, I really wasn't funny in that. It really freaked me out. So I was sweating blood the whole time I was at the table.
Yeah.
That they would give it to me just because it was in a popular TV show, not because I deserved it. But thankfully, I think it was the same year Catherine Tate really kind of broke out, and I think she won it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Well, I mean, I'll leave it there. Obviously, you've got a lot ahead this year with Submergence and Coldest City on their way, right?
Yeah.
Other than that, good luck with everything that's ahead.
Thanks, man.
I hope it all continues to go well with this amazing press run.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Sir.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. What a lovely dude, and what a lovely episode. I know this is a shorter one
than normal. I know they're normally longer, but I thought it was well worth it because it was a great opportunity to talk to the young man. Incidentally, I really enjoyed Split. If you're a fan of M. Night, I reckon you'll feel it. It's really good fun. My favourite M. Night film is Unbreakable. And I know that's not everyone's favourite M. Night film. A lot of people love Sixth Sense. I think Sixth Sense is great. And there's other good ones. But my favourite has always been Unbreakable. And if Unbreakable is your favourite, then you're going to love Split. Because it's got that same essence to me. You'll really enjoy it. Do you mind if I ramble on a little bit now? Because I've got loads of stuff to tell you and loads of stuff to chat about. So what's been going on? We've had an amazing reaction to the Rob Parker podcast. That was one of my favourites. I love it when there's a guest on that's not that famous, but gets a really good reaction just because of the chat and conversation. And then the week after that, I had Matt Willis. And again, got an amazing reaction. It was interesting, though, because with the Rob Parker episode, people were saying how I could barely get a word in edgeways, a few people. But again, in a warm and friendly way. And then on the Matt Willis one, I had two different people. I mean, that's two out of, 100,000 of that listened. I had two people say, man, you kept interrupting Matt. So if you got mad at me interrupting Matt, I'm sorry, but I get excited on some of these, and when I'm excited that can get a bit interrupted. You've also got to bear in mind that you're not in the room, so you don't know what the situation is. Sometimes I'll interrupt if it feels like someone's getting stuck or getting lost in on that particular one. I'm not making excuses. I've not listened to it, but I'm perfectly happy with how much I interrupted because we had a lovely time. But in that particular one, we kept getting interrupted, and I had my back to the door and Matt was facing the door, so often he'd kind of be mid something and kind of someone would walk in and he'd be indicating for them to go off, so sometimes I'd jump in that way. But anyway, whatever, I've made my BBC One network television debut this week, or last week as this comes out. How crazy is that? So big love to everyone who's been supporting Taboo, man. The reaction has been amazing. So let me tell you a little bit about the spoken word piece I did. So for anyone who doesn't know, I'm in a series called Taboo with Tom Hardy and Stephen Graham. And it's written by Stephen Knight and produced by Ridley Scott and some amazing people. And I kind of convinced the BBC to let me do a spoken word piece about it. And it's quite irreverent, let's say. Let's put that in a polite way. It's quite aggressive and sweary and irreverent. And much to my surprise, they really liked it. And even more to my surprise, I didn't know this was going to happen. At 9 o'clock, so it premiered at 9:15 on BBC One on Saturday night, two Saturdays ago now, or the Saturday before, the one that's just gone. They at 9 o'clock, they posted it on their Twitter and on their Facebook and shared it out there with literally millions of people. So I got a wonderful wave of love and affection and loveliness and tons of nice things said about it. The BBC have been dead happy because they've it got a really good reaction, as said. I've done great in kind of tricking people into thinking that this whole show is about me. It's not. I've got like a role in it. There's no such thing as a small role. There is only small actors, as Stevie Graham would regularly remind me on set anytime I was being all humble and shit. But yeah, I've kind of, it's really, it wasn't intentional. I was just kind of like, oh, I written this spoken word piece, and Hardy liked it and the BBC liked it. But I seem to have scammed my way into being, like, still, obviously, I'm not the main thing people are talking about, but I reckon cast-wise, I'm probably in the top 10 that are getting, like, mentions online and stuff, when I don't deserve to be at all. The cast is insanely good, and they're all way more experienced and way better than me, but a homie's got a hustle, you know what I mean? So that's been good. That's been absolutely lovely. The other thing I want to tell you about, some of the podcasts I've got coming up, because I've got some wicked ones coming up. My order now. Hopefully next week, again, this is all touch and go, but hopefully next week I'll be talking to Garth Jennings, and that'd be great if that can happen. If not, I might do an Ask Pip, because they always go down well, and I've not done one in a while. So keep an eye on my Facebook for that. So I'm going to have that. And then the week after that, I'm going to have a homelessness special. And I've recorded this. It's in two parts. And I've spoken to a guy I've known for years, in fact, who set up a organisation called Facebook page and all this called Haircuts for the Homeless. And it's an amazing story. And it's amazing when you think about how giving haircuts sounds kind of frivolous, but it's a massive thing because it's kind of almost a therapist chair. You think of how much you talk to someone, and you think of how rare it is that you allow someone in your personal space in that way, and also the pride you give someone back potentially when you give them, you know, you can make them look nice and give them a haircut. So I've got, yeah, Stuart Roberts from Haircuts for the Homeless, and then I went up to Manchester and talked to Mustard Tree, who are a fantastic organisation that do a lot of different things for homeless people, for those on the verge of homelessness, for those getting over homelessness and getting their lives back together. And I talked to Soraya up there, who works for Mustard Tree, and Anthony, who has come through Mustard Tree and come from homelessness, and he's got an amazing story. So, yeah, they're really exciting ones. Then, after that, I'm going to Holland to record a couple. So I'm going to be sitting down. Again, if any of these fall through, I apologise. But I'm going to be talking with Ancilla van der Leest, who's I heard of her as a online privacy activist, essentially, doing a lot of things about our changes and how we're kind of getting a bit loose with our privacy and security. And then she's recently been elected to one of the positions in the Pirate Party in Holland, which is a political party out there. So that'll be great. And then also while I'm out there, I'm going to be talking to Wim Hof, who I'm incredibly excited about, who came up in the conversation in this episode with James McAvoy. And Wim Hof, I heard on the Joe Rogan podcast originally, the Joe Rogan Experience, and he's this Dutch dude who was seen for a little while as kind of this eccentric Dutch guy who can handle temperatures, but like he's climbed Everest numerous times. He's got the world record for fastest Kilimanjaro climb in his pants or in his shorts. So he's this guy who could just always handle extreme temperatures. He did things like he swam under huge iced areas and just insane things. And you know, there's always been people throughout the ages that it's like, oh, he's this eccentric anomaly. But Wim was adamant that no, it's a technique and it's a conscious thing, and it's using breathing techniques and almost meditation techniques to take control of the cells in your body and control your core temperature. He's also used it a lot for health reasons and to control your immune system. And it was kind of like, oh, this guy's cool, but not taken that seriously. And then a university tested it all under test conditions and had Wim like stand in a block of ice, and they monitored his temperatures, and he maintained a steady body temperature. And then they did a blind test where he got like 5 different people or 10 different people and taught 5 of them the Wim Hof technique and 5 a fake version of the Wim Hof technique, with them thinking it was the real one. And the 5 who taught the real technique managed to control their core temperatures and things like that. So yeah, anyway, he's a fascinating guy. So that one is to come. And what else is to come? Me and Johnny Lee Miller are trying to get some time to chat, but it's hectic schedules and that, so I'm not promising that one, but we're doing our best. I'm going to have Dan Hardy back on at some point because people have been requesting that a lot recently. Susan Wacoma, who I love from Chewing Gum. Chewing Gum started last week and it was hilarious. Series 2 started on Channel 4 and it was great, so I recommend you check that out. And she was in Chewing Gum, and she was also in Crazy Head, which I really enjoyed at the end of last year. So yeah, there's loads of good people coming up. I'm looking at my list in front of me, and there's a load on there that I've spoken to about it, but we've not got anything firm in. So I'm not going to mention them, because I remember for about a year or two before I had Lauren Laverne on, I was saying, are Lauren Laverne on soon? And just schedules get in the way. So it didn't happen. But yeah, we'll get there. I think that's everything to tell you, right? The Distraction Pieces book, I've not plugged that in a while, but we did a book of the podcast, and it became a Times bestseller, and it was insane, because it became, I've said this numerous times, but it became a far better thing than I expected it to be when I started making it. I thought it'd just be kind of a collection, but it turned into this cool thing. But I've rambled about that before, and there's a blog about that at scroobiuspip.co.uk, so if that's of interest, go give that a looky-see. We're rejigging and revamping and reigniting the Distraction Pieces social media pages. I've got some new people helping out, and the Facebook page is going to come to life. We're going to launch an Instagram page and push everything on there. So yeah, that's going to be good. There's some good Tuesday Night Jaws coming up. I'm going to be on Tuesday Night Jaw for the Royal Rumble roundup in a week or two. I can't tell you who the other guests are, but they're good. Or they're hopefully good. The last time I heard, the people Jim was trying to get were good. So I'm excited about that. Club night. Yeah, that's something I should mention. January, what is it? It's the Saturday, the 28th, right? January 28th, we finally return to the book club with We Are Lizards. We've got Sean Keaveney as our guest DJ, Sean Keaveney of Six Music fame. So come down and party with us on January 28th. I'm normally there from 7-8 o'clock until we close at 2. So come and enjoy yourself. I can't wait to put on my rubber lizard mask and get a bit boozy and play all the best songs for you all. So that'll be nice. Just going through my calendar to see if there's anything else I need to tell you about. I don't think there is. So I will leave it there. Again, this is a little shorter than usual, but hopefully you're all right with that, because wasn't James cracking? And to be honest, there's some people who think I'm a bit too rambly and all over the place. That's kind of the nature of the podcast. Chill the fuck out, yeah? But there's some that think I'm like that, but I couldn't be like that on this episode because I had a limited amount of time. So I was all fucking succinct and professional and shit, which is probably going to annoy you now because you know that I'm capable of that. And I choose to generally be a rambly, nonsensical idiot most of the time. So unlucky, guys. Again, if you're new to this, thank you for tuning. If you're new to this, you wouldn't still be listening now, because why would you bother? You would have tuned out ages ago. But yeah, check out the back catalogue. We've had Simon Pegg, Stephen Graham, Paddy Considine, Nick Frost, Michael Smiley. Loads of really good actors. We've had loads of good people. Georgina Campbell, who's fantastic. Michaela Cole, who I mentioned earlier in Chewing Gum. So loads of really good people. Go check them out. Oh, I should also while I'm here on this long-ass outro, I should mention the Drunkcast T-shirts are available. So I think we've probably sold out of the bundles, but you can get the Drunkcast T-shirts at, where can you get it? SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. And there's a Stu one, a Chris/Craig one, and a Pip one. So go and check them out there. They're selling fast and we're running out. We've got limited stock on a few sizes of sold out on each one. But yeah, go and check them out. Anyway, I shall bid you farewell. Thank you for tuning in. I've been Scroobius Pip. You can find me at Scroobius Pip Yo on Twitter and Instagram, or facebook.com/Scroobius Pip. See you next week, guys. Ta-ta!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.